It's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 16th of November 2013. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butcher. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua. On Saturday the 16th of November, Sharon Brown talked to the author of a book on inequality in New Zealand, Max Rushbrook. And she spoke to Weremu from Living Without Violence about White Ribbon Day.
Today I've got, I don't even know how to say your name, Max Rushbrook, is that right?
That's correct.
Lovely, yep. Great. So Max Rushbrook is in the studio, and he's written a book called Inequality, a New Zealand Crisis, and we were incredibly lucky last night to hear you speak at Tivoli.
Yes, it was a great event last night. I had a great time.
Yeah, great. So you've been going around the country promoting this book?
Yeah, pretty much. We published the book in June, and ever since then I've been going around and doing talks in, well, pretty much the whole of the North Island, you know, Napier, Rotorua, New Plymouth, wherever. Did some talks in the top of the South Island. And yeah, over this weekend, I was talking last night here, and then I'm doing a talk in Auckland proper on Monday night, just trying to get out there and kind of spread the word to as many people as possible.
Lovely. So the book is called Inequality, a New Zealand Crisis. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question is, well, how unequal is New Zealand, and what does that actually mean? And also, so what? Why is it a crisis?
Well, both good questions. How unequal are we? Well, if you sort of go back to the mid-1980s, we were one of the most equal countries in the world. And at that point, someone who was in the top 10% earned maybe five times as much as someone who was in the bottom 10%. So that's a pretty small ratio. Since then, we've had the biggest increase in the gap between rich and poor of any developed country. And we're now at a point where, you know, in the last sort of 30 years or so, people's incomes at the bottom have barely shifted while they've doubled at the top. So someone at the top is now earning closer to 10 times as much as someone at the bottom. So, you know, from a 5-to-1 ratio to a 10-to-1 ratio, that's been a really huge shift over the last 30 years.
And has that been a greater shift than in other countries? Just yeah. Because it's, I think New Zealand indicators and inequality were actually much closer before, weren't they, than some other countries?
Yeah, I mean, we're not the most unequal country in the developed world, not by a long shot. But we were coming from a base of being such an equal country that we've had, you know, really the biggest rise in inequality of any developed country. So we've been affected by that shift more than anywhere else in the world.
Mm. And so what kind of inequality are we talking about? And also, yeah, why is it an issue?
Well, we're mostly focusing on income inequality with the book. Not because incomes are the only things that matter in this life. I mean, they're not, obviously. There's a lot of things that go into, you know, making for a good life. But I think we all know that income plays a huge part in determining what kind of life you can have, you know, what chance you have to actually achieve your dreams, you know, to lead a life that you value. And so we really focus in on those income inequalities because it makes such a big difference to people's individual lives, but also because there's something about a society with really big income gaps that is not very functional, you know, that has high levels of stress, that has, you know, very high levels of social problems. So it's worth really narrowing in on income differences and looking at what has happened with those.
Mm. So were you quite influenced by things like the spirit level and the research done in that area? Because I was quite amazed when I read that there were so many indicators like, you know, more unequal societies had greater numbers of people in jail, had greater levels of unhappiness, had greater levels of obesity, it was just, the list just went on and on and on.
Yeah, no, that has been a really influential book. And what they do that's so powerful is they show that, you know, all those health and social problems, all those things you don't want to see, are really much, much more common in very unequal societies. And they also spell out a reason why that would be. Well, a number of reasons. And a lot of it is to do, oddly enough, with stress. You know, when you live in a society that has very big income gaps, you have a lot of what's called, you know, psychosocial stress, you know, people's sense of being unequal, of feeling inferior to other people, of sensing that there are these very big hierarchies and divisions. And that, you know, drives a whole lot of things, particularly, you know, heart disease, but also all the stuff that's linked to stress, like obesity. And, you know, countries with big income gaps, yeah, also have things like very high imprisonment rates. I mean, New Zealand has about 200 people per 100,000 population in prison. That is one of the highest in the developed world. And that's doubled in the last couple of decades, even though our crime rate has dropped. And that's because, you know, the more unequal you get, the more people tend to be punitive. You know, the more they want, more they're out for punishment rather than, you know, reconciliation and rehabilitation. So your books like The Spirit Level have been really influential, and they're doing the international picture. And what I thought we needed was a book that took that kind of spotlight and turned it on New Zealand and said, well, what's going on with inequality in New Zealand?
Mm. And so, so many questions. And so what specific differences have you noticed or similarities have you noticed in terms of New Zealand in relation to some of the statistics that you see overseas?
Well, I think things like our imprisonment rate, like I just mentioned, are really, really striking. You know, we put so many people in prison. I mean, there's really, in the Western world, there's only the US and Poland and a couple of other places that imprison more people than we do, even though our crime rate has been dropping for the last 20 years. So that's really striking. Another thing is we have this terrible record on childhood infectious diseases. You know, and these are totally preventable diseases, like rheumatic fever. You know, our rates of those diseases since 1990 have increased 50%, while everywhere else, pretty much in the developed world, they've actually fallen. You know, and that is because we have these huge inequalities, particularly in housing stock, and we have so many people in New Zealand growing up in, you know, very damp, overcrowded, unhealthy housing. Yeah, and I think that really is, I mean, one of the sort of leading researchers in this field called it a national embarrassment. And I really think it is.
And so we haven't always been an unequal society. So what are the drivers and to make us more unequal? How is that coming about?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting thing because, you know, like I said, we were one of the world's most equal countries prior to the mid-80s. Now, you don't want to say off the back of that that means that everything was perfect. You know, that sort of equality wasn't extended to Māori and it wasn't extended to women. You know, we had a very welfare state that was very much focused around, you know, white males, basically. But it was still, you know, a really important achievement. And what has happened since then is, you know, a couple of things, I guess. There's been a really big shift in power sort of in the workplace. You know, people at the bottom have far less bargaining power than they used to. People at the top have a lot of power, particularly, you know, to shift capital all around the world and take their business where they want. And so that kind of shift in the workplace means that even though people are working much harder and more productively than they used to, the benefits are not going to the vast majority of, you know, salary earners. It's just going to a small number of people at the top. So you've got that initial inequality, and then the second thing that happens is the government does less to narrow that gap than it used to through the tax and benefit system because, you know, we've cut tax rates at the top, we've increased GST, which hits hardest on those people at the bottom, and we've cut benefits. So that even with working for families, you know, we redistribute far less than we used to. And then the third big thing is, of course, is globalisation, which has affected everyone, you know, and takes a lot of previously well-paying jobs out of the country and kind of leads to a bit of a divided workforce. So you've got all those, you know, and they're big, complex things going on. There's no one thing that's driven inequality, but it's the result of all those forces.
Okay. So, but it's quite, I mean, another thing it occurs to me to say, and I'm on shaky ground here because I'm not that familiar with New Zealand's recent history, but I know that when it was severely regulated, in retrospect, a lot of people have seen the liberalisation of the was it the late 80s, the 90s, as being a huge benefit to New Zealand, and you know, people's wealth increased and they had so many more advantages and it was easier for them to travel and buy cars and all of these kinds of things. So it's just a sort of a reflection. It's almost, but at the time, I think New Zealanders felt, certainly white New Zealanders felt unequal to maybe white counterparts in other parts of the world. So there was a perception of inequality that they maybe felt they wanted to redress.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really complex picture, and what you have to not do is think that it was just there was a black and white kind of binary choice, you know, that the only options were going on with New Zealand the way it was up until the mid-80s, which, was an economy with huge problems, which had never adjusted to the fact that we could no longer just export, you know, our meat to the European Union, to Britain. But people will try to say, well, that wasn't sustainable. So the only option was the path that we took in the 80s, and the result of that is inequality. Well, too bad. But that's a totally false choice, you know, because there was always the third option, which was that, yes, you modernise your economy, yes, you open it up to global competition, but you do so in the same way that, say, the Scandinavian countries have done, where you have a very dynamic, modern, open, flexible economy, but, you know, you have high levels of equality as well. You know, you invest hugely in job retraining programs for people who have been put out of work. You invest heavily in social services, particularly those that help children and give people a good start in life. There was always, you know, a third option there where you could have retained the good bits of the old New Zealand, the equality, while jettisoning, you know, the narrow-mindedness, the conformity, the sort of the fortress New Zealand stuff. That's the path that we didn't take, that arguably we should have taken, and it's through not taking that path that we've ended up with this huge and, you know, totally avoidable level of inequality that we have now.
So how does one redress the inequality? What kinds of steps would need to be taken?
Well, if you think about those sort of two steps that I outlined when we're talking about what's caused it, you know, this widening gap, difference in the salaries that people earn in the first place, and then the fact that we do less to close that up when we used to, that kind of tells you, you know, where you should probably put your focus in terms of, you know, potentially redressing the gap. I mean, listen, you know, we're still kind of starting off this discussion, and what I'm trying to do with the book and what the other authors in the book are doing is really just putting the facts in front of people so that they can start having a conversation about, you know, what you might do about it. But, yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about how you tackle it, well, you need to change the power dynamic in the workplace, and that probably involves, you know, increasing the bargaining power of people at the bottom, whether that's through, you know, better collective bargaining or, you know, more staff representatives on boards of directors, that kind of thing.
So just on that note, what I notice is that whole bargaining power is being actively whittled away, like workers' conditions, especially under things like, you know, pressures of what seems to work in other countries, means that people are on, you know, well, like what we had with Ports of Auckland, this sort of trying to force people into contracts that they might only have an hour a week or, you know, 50 hours a week, or, you know, complete flexibility demanded of the workforce for no more reason, while you might want some of the workforce to be flexible, but almost trying to make the whole of the workforce feel uncertain. And so, you know, how does that work? Because on the one hand, there seem to be active policies to undermine the workforce, and yet we know that in order to create equality, we need to have better worker participation within any organisation.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, and that kind of argument about the nature of work, how it functions and who's in control of it, is, you know, a huge part of the inequality story. And what we haven't really done, I mean, because the way the world of work has changed has been driven by this need for flexibility, you know, and the fact that everything happens faster and in less predictable ways. You know, you don't have the 9-to-5 workforce anymore. Now, and what we haven't really done as a country is we haven't sort of sat down and said, well, okay, some of that is fine. I mean, because, you know, the world of work has changed and some flexibility is fine and it's good and some people actually really enjoy that. But we haven't sat down and said, okay, this flexibility is good, but there are other things going on, you know, some of the casualisation stuff, that is not, because it makes it impossible for people to plan their lives. It makes it hard for them to be good parents, makes it hard for them, you know, to take any part in their community or have a decent, stable life when they don't know from one day to the next actually how much work they have coming in. And we haven't, you know, adapted to that. We haven't said, here are the situations where actually that's not okay, or here are the situations where if it's going to happen, we'll completely reshape, say, the welfare system so that actually accommodates that different kind of working life that people have. You know, we just, and people are starting to wake up to those issues and address them, but that's a huge, huge debate that we need to have.
So who needs to, where does that push need to come from? Is that something that needs to be decided through government policy, or is that something, you know, because it's very difficult as workers are more and more disenfranchised and as people compete more for fewer jobs at the lower end, it becomes more and more difficult to actually have a voice.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're going to tackle that, it's a big issue and there's a lot of things you'd need to do. I mean, you've got issues around what are the big picture economic settings. You know, I mean, at the moment, we don't, you know, full employment is not a target that we have anymore. We used to. You know, instead, we, you know, basically target trying to keep inflation down. Now, there's an argument that we need to rebalance that and put a lot more attention on trying to create, you know, something closer to full employment. So you've got the big picture stuff. In terms of the real drive, well, the Council of Trade Unions has just put out some research, a report called Under Pressure, which is about exactly what you're talking about, precarious work. So they're starting to, you know, articulate an agenda about how you deal with that. You've also got things like the Living Wage Campaign, which is a community campaign. It's got community groups, church groups, and trade unions saying, you know, actually, really, people need to be paid $18.40 an hour, not $13.75, because that's actually what you need to survive as a family. And if you pay people that, you know, higher wage, then they're more productive at work, you know, they generate more value, so employers benefit, but also they can be better members of their community. You know, they don't have to work such long hours, so they're better parents, they're more involved in things. So they're starting to push back on that kind of work agenda and push for greater equality. And that's a really powerful campaign that's just being led by the community.
So it's, again, on the living wage thing, so there seem to be clear benefits in having a living wage. How does that work for sort of small employers? Because a lot of New Zealand businesses are sort of employing at the 4-5%, five-person staff or less. And so, you know, juggling your books, especially if you're working a contract, and then, you know, the contract doesn't come through, but you're still having to pay staff, it all becomes a bit tricky. And, you know, some smaller employers are really worried. And then I think a lot of the bigger employers, like, you know, McDonald's or Subway or whatever, are kind of riding off the the fact that it's quite convenient to have everyone paid not very much.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And one of the key things about the Living Wage Campaign is it's totally voluntary. I mean, it's never going to be enforced on businesses. And I think people involved in it do recognise that there are businesses that probably cannot afford to pay $18.40 an hour. I mean, if you're hypothetically a bookshop in a small town, it's hard to see how you're going to generate a whole lot more productivity out of your employees that would justify paying that extra. So there will be businesses that can't pay it. But, you know, the thing about if you've got people who are paid a living wage, they will be spending all of that money because they have to, and they will be spending it generally in their local economy on really basic things. So if you get a shift across a local economy to the living wage, then everybody benefits. And then even if, say, you're a small bookshop owner, you probably could afford to increase your staff to the living wage, because if everybody else in the community is in the living wage, they'll be hopefully spending more money in your local store. And so I think, you know, it gets a lot easier for everybody's doing it. But I think the main target of the campaign really is employers like, you know, say the big companies that are running, you know, aged care homes, where they make literally millions and millions of dollars of profit and they pay their carers $14.80 an hour. You know, that's the real target.
Interesting. And so I guess I'd just quite like to target particular things like capital gains tax. Is that likely to be something that's helpful in the mix and would help reduce inequality, or is that just a bit of a red herring?
No, I think it's, there's no one solution. But a capital gains tax is something that would definitely create greater equality, because at the moment you have the huge inequality that if you make your money a standard way, through a salary, you're taxed on it as personal income. If you make your money through selling houses, or other kinds of assets, you are generally not taxed on that. So, and that's just totally unequal. More broadly, a capital gains tax, wealth taxes, would address the fact that, you have inequalities of income in New Zealand, and that's a huge issue. You also have massive inequalities of wealth, the actual assets that people own. And that's much, much greater than the inequality and just in how much people take in on a year-to-year basis, the income. And if you're going to tackle inequality, then you really need to look at that wealth and asset side of things as well.
Things like, I've just noticed there are some interesting initiatives in other countries. I think, is it Switzerland or it might be somewhere else, where they've suggested that what people earn in a year can't be more than what someone else earns in a month?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, what someone earns in a month can't be more than what someone else earns in a year?
Yeah. It's in Switzerland, where they have all these referenda, which are binding and which are initiated by citizens. Their latest one, which they're voting on, I think, in a couple of weeks, is saying that the within a company you can't have your top earner paid more than 12 times. I think it's the lowest earner, or it might be the average earner, I can't remember. Yeah, and that's a really strong argument, which is saying that, there's nothing wrong with people being paid well, if they're in responsible positions, but they should only be paid well if everybody else in their company is as well, because that's only fair, because everybody's contributing to the success of that company. So they're voting on that in Switzerland. In the US, companies are about to have to start reporting on that ratio between their top earner and their bottom earner. Once you shine that spotlight on, once it's reported on, then there's a potential for action to be taken around it. So that idea, which is not about setting an absolute limit, but it's about saying, we need to tie the salaries of people at the top to those at the bottom, is one that's really gaining ground around the world.
Interesting. And so other initiatives that could help or have proven successful in other places?
One of the other things that we canvass in the book is an unconditional basic income. It's an idea that's been promoted by Gareth Morgan, but a lot of other people as well. And that idea is that everybody, because we as people all have certain rights as citizens, everybody's entitled to a decent minimum income. You would pay everybody as of right with no conditions, say $11,000 a year. And you could fund that. Morgan's proposal is you fund that with a flat tax rate on income and an annual charge that's levied on all the assets that people own, which that starts to target some of that wealth inequality that I talked about. Now, listen, I'm not saying that that is the right idea or it's the full answer, but it is one of the options that is out there. And I think it's useful to talk about that because it helps people see there are some concrete ideas. There is the living wage, there are pay ratios, there's an unconditional basic income. This is not an impossible thing that you can't do anything about. There are ideas out there.
So we've kind of been talking about inequality, but what is the inequality? Do you have some of those statistics on what the inequality is? Because I know sometimes when I see them, I'm like, oh my God, who knew? That's insane. The difference between, they're like 1% statistics. And do you have any of those? Because I think sometimes people don't realize the extent of, we're not talking about some people doing a bit better and, living the New Zealand dream and all of that. We're actually talking about like severe differences in equality.
And it's one of the things I really find, and this is why for me doing a book and something like that is worthwhile, because I put those figures out in front of people and the most common reaction is, God, I had no idea it was that bad.
So what are some of the figures?
Well, if you look at what has happened in the last 30 years, someone in the bottom 10% their after-tax income has barely increased. You know, it's gone from about $9,700 a year to about $11,000 a year. So they really have seen none of that supposed trickle down.
Especially as bread is at least three times as expensive as it was. Yeah.
I mean, those figures are inflation adjusted, so some of that is taken into account. But so barely any increase at the bottom. Conversely, the income of someone in the top 1% has gone from before tax about $150,000 a year to over $300,000 a year. So not only are their incomes massively, massively higher than those people at the bottom, but they've doubled in the last 30 years, while those at the bottom have almost not really increased much at all.
And in terms of accessing the assets or control of assets, what's the distribution like there?
Well, unsurprisingly, that's even more unequal than it is for income, because you know, you have these big differences in income, and that builds up over time into huge differences in who owns what. So the top 1% of New Zealand adults, which is sort of around about 35,000 people, they own 16% of all the assets in New Zealand. Conversely, the 1.5 million adults in the bottom half of the distribution own just 5% of all the assets. So you've got a tiny handful of people, really, 30,000 or so, owning three times as much as the whole of the bottom half of the country. And that's, you know, a really enormous, enormous inequality of wealth.
And how do, while we're talking about the word asset, I'm thinking asset sales referendum. Does that have any bearing on this conversation, state assets and wealth?
Yeah, I mean, it's another thing that probably tends to increase inequality, because, you know, share ownership, unsurprisingly, tends to be concentrated, you know, amongst the top 1%, 2%, 5%. You know, it's not something that's broadly shared. And, you know, you're seeing that particularly as the number of people who are subscribing to the asset sales is falling as the program goes on. And you look at, you know, share ownership generally does tend to be very concentrated. I think that will probably increase inequality.
Well, I thought it was quite interesting that apparently the Mighty River shares went to 2% of the population. So, I mean, they did a huge campaign on all the TV stations and, you know, the banks. ASB couldn't wait to try and get me, you know, roped into some, you know, share buying.
And
I thought it was quite interesting that in spite of that, it's gone to 2% of New Zealanders.
Yeah, that is kind of an inevitable consequence. It doesn't matter, in a sense, you know, what your own personal political view is about the wisdom of asset sales. The simple fact is that most people, you know, the average person in New Zealand does not have a lot of money in the bank, full stop. I mean, you know, most people just don't, simply don't have the money sitting around that you would need, you know, the couple of thousand dollars you would need to stump up to buy shares in Mighty River Power or Meridian. So inevitably, just as a consequence of, you know, where the assets already are, you know, when you sell them off, they are going to tend to accumulate amongst a relatively small number of people.
Okay, so how does voting and elections and, you know, that play into all of this? Because, in a sense, we want perhaps government to take on board some of this responsibility to do things. But is there that much interest from government in doing this?
I think what there is a growing public interest in it, and politicians always respond to that public demand with a bit of a lag and with, you know, some constraints, obviously, in terms of what their own interests are and where their funding comes from and all the rest of it. But they do respond. And what I find really heartening is that, you know, a couple of years ago, inequality wasn't really registering as an issue with New Zealanders. And I think that's because, you know, in the wake of something like the GFC, most people just hunker down and they just want to make sure that they're all right. They're not worried about the bigger picture. But then once the economy starts to recover, you know, and we're technically in a growth phase, and people see that they're not necessarily benefiting from that, then suddenly they become really interested in inequality because they want to know who is benefiting. So it's really kind of risen up the agenda. And, you know, there was a poll that came out in August, didn't get a lot of coverage, But it showed that when you ask people what is the number one issue in New Zealand, more people say inequality than anything else, you know, more even than the economy or unemployment generally. So that's really up there in the public consciousness now. And, you know, I think people are responding to that. It's increasingly part of the debate. Certainly Labour and the Greens have really picked up on it. And you're also even seeing people like Bill English starting to say, yep, well, you know, look, we're addressing inequality. This is what the system already does to, you know, reduce inequalities. It's becoming part of the language. You almost can't have the conversation now without touching on it at some level.
And do you think the conversation that's being had is paying lip service to the inequality and addressing it, or it's genuinely trying to address the inequality? Because, for example, I get the feeling sometimes that there's a sense in which we just want to manage people's expectations around inequality, but those macro structures are not really being cleaned up or addressed. And so, for example, we've got things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is still being negotiated in secret in spite of, you know, massive protests across all these different countries, which see it as as another thing that can add to inequality or poverty within the community.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, inevitably, you know, within the discussion, there's a real range of opinions, and some people's, you know, efforts to tackle the issue are more genuine than others. I mean, I think you've got a lot of people who really do want to do something concrete about it. You've also got people who, you know, will come some of the way, but not the whole way. I mean, you get a lot of people, it's really interesting, who talk about education, for example. Education is the answer to inequality. Now, education is really important. I mean, it can be an incredibly empowering thing. But, you know, you come back to sort of that power dynamic stuff I was talking about. You know, there's not a lot of point really educating people fantastically well if they then go into a workplace where they're not rewarded for their skills, because the power dynamic is against them and all that money is going to the people who've got capital or whatever. So, you know, kind of sort of the discussions I'm having with people is, you know, if you've come some of the way, you know, and you think that inequality is an issue, but you think all you need to do about it is, you know, put a bit more money into education, I'm trying to take people a bit further along that path and say, well, yep, that's valid and that's valuable, but that's really not going to sort things out by itself. You have to do a whole lot more things. So I'm trying to shift the conversation into being, you know, a bit deeper and a bit more of a genuine one.
And what would some of those things focus on?
Well, I mean, we've touched on some of it already. I mean, it's about trying to strengthen people's ability to, you know, bargain collectively, make workplaces more democratic. You know, you could have more staff representatives on boards of directors and on the companies that set chief executive pay, you know, things like that. Because, you know, when you're talking about inequality, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about what happens at the lower end, you know, how to lift people out of poverty. And that obviously is the number one priority. But you can't forget what goes on at the top levels as well, and you need to think about, well, you know, decent salaries for genuinely great performance are fine, but actually the evidence is that we, in the current system, you know, people at the top are getting paid well for good performance and they're getting paid well for bad performance. So how has that link got broken? How do you, you know, restrain top incomes to a point that is reasonable and is legitimate and is based on, you know, some extra talent or contribution or whatever? So you need to look at things across the whole spectrum.
Oh, very interesting. It seems quite a challenge. I always think it seems like quite a challenge because I don't think it's by chance that we've reached such incredible levels of inequality and that the gap between rich and poor is increasing. I mean, it's not a sort of, I don't think it's an accident. I think it's the result of active policies that have, you know, disenfranchised the worker, or, you know, neoliberal economics or whatever, globalization, that have created uncertainty. And so I see it as a really big push uphill to try and redress it. And I'm also concerned, I mean, and maybe you've got some ideas around this, but, you know, you've got in elections, how do you vote? Because essentially in a system where both, where, you know, big parties are all funded in quite similar ways, I mean, admittedly, there's more of a link between Labour and the trade unions, but they're not going to, they don't seem significantly different. Is there a difference?
Yeah, I mean, you know, on that first point, it is a really difficult thing to do, to turn inequality around. Someone said it's a bit like, you know, dealing with weight issues. It's a lot easier to put it on than it is to take it off, unfortunately. And you do need a pretty big push, and you're fighting against, you know, some of the forces like globalization do push very hard in the direction of greater inequality. So you can't sort of, unfortunately, say that it's going to be an easy thing to do. But you can do it, and there are lessons you can learn from history. You know, the things that, because New Zealand was a very unequal place in the 1920s, and we became strikingly more equal from World War II onward through until the early 80s. So there are lessons from history. There are things that other countries do that you can learn from. You know, there are things, and there's these things we've been discussing already, you know, so there are options there. And yeah, I mean, the political parties, it is difficult because they are, you know, more reliant on funding from the top 1% than is really desirable, and that certainly acts as a check on progress, I think. You know, the only good thing is we can be grateful we're not in America, you know, where the influence of the top 1% on politics is really obscene, actually, and pretty out of control, thanks to some recent court judgments that basically make it almost impossible to restrain spending there. So I think, yeah, you do need to keep focused on where the politicians' sources of income and funding are coming from. But I don't think that means you can't get any progress through politics. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of what has got us into this inequality has been specific government policies. So those are things that can be unwound again. Yeah, if there's a popular will to do it.
Oh, how very optimistic. That's great. No, I love it. I mean, it's great. You know. Now, you're a journalist.
Yep.
And how did you come to be interested in this topic?
Well, I guess, I mean, in a strange way, I first started getting interested in it when I was out of the country. I worked in London for 5 or 6 years as a journalist. And it was just at that point that I started doing a lot of reading around the subject. And in doing that reading, discovered that fact I mentioned earlier, that New Zealand had the biggest increase, you know, mid-80s to mid-2000s, of any developed country in terms of its income gaps. And then I came home in 2010 and was struck, you know, personally by seeing the evidence of that, you know, working in a soup kitchen, doing some of the research I did, you know, going and living in boarding houses and other places where, you know, people who are really excluded from society are. And that just kind of made me think, well, you know, this is a huge issue for New Zealand that we really haven't kind of grappled with, and we really should be, you know. And so I ended up doing this book, basically.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. I mean, I'm always really interested because, you know, essentially writing a book is quite a challenge, quite time consuming, quite an expensive thing to do. And I think you have to have a lot of commitment or, you know, some source of income to be able to do it. So I always think it's great when people kind of break through and are able to, you know, either make a film, write a book, whatever it is, and especially on something that's quite important. You know, it seems that there's a lot of really useful documentation in the book that can take us forward.
Yeah, and it is difficult working on books like this. You know, the main issue is really finding the time for people to write. And this is an issue across the board in New Zealand publishing. You know, I mean, the book, you know, my book, Inequality in New Zealand Crisis, I mean, I edited and wrote large chunks of it, but, you know, luckily we could draw on, actually a lot of it is written by other people who are experts in their field. And that made it a bit easier to put together. But there was still, you know, we had to cover my writing time and the editing time, and we were only able to do that because my publisher got funding from people like the Council of Christian Social Services, who have been great supporters of the book, the J.R. McKenzie Trust, you know, philanthropists like that, and some support from private individuals who don't want to be named, but whose support was really generous and is hugely, you know, hugely important in doing something like this. But it's a big problem in New Zealand. You know, we don't have enough good books about current issues that are, you know, looking at them in a way that's accessible but rigorous and powerful, because there's so little funding for this kind of thing, and it's so hard for people to clear the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's actually really, and that was probably my last question, is this whole notion of how do we make the people who are earning the most and are most successful in society realize that it's to their benefit to reduce inequality in society? Because you can have all these government policies and they're driven by people who, or, you know, you can see why if you're at the bottom of the pile, you'd obviously want to be doing better. But at the same time, there are things that show that more unequal society, in more unequal societies, life expectancy for everyone is lower than in societies where there's more equality. So actually everyone benefits from a more equal society. But how do we get that message through? Because I think there's something in individuals which thinks that I would like to be so much better off and I would like to have the house on the hill. So how do we get people to think you know, in a more sort of is it holistic or sort of what's the word? Be more community-minded in the way they think.
Well, I think you've absolutely hit on it in both senses. I mean, yeah, one of the key messages of the book is that, you know, a huge swathe of us will be better off for living in a more equal society, not just people in the lowest 10%. But, you know, conversely, it's not always easy to get that argument across. You know, I mean, I think we're doing it, and we're starting to do it, and just, you know, these kind of conversations we're having where we're pointing out, you know, the evidence is that most people are better off in a more equal society. You know, they have better health and better life expectancy. Well, you have to, that's how you do it. You have those arguments. You try and create that, you know, change in consciousness. And that's why in my talks I talk a lot about the things that affect everybody. You know, the decline in trust when you have an unequal society. You know, I mean, basically society and the economy in a wider sense runs on trust. Yeah, and that's something that people understand. You talk to people about, well, wouldn't you rather be living in a society where you might, you know, be taxed a bit more, but you don't have civil unrest, or you don't have the same level of muggings, you don't have the same level of burglaries. You know, everybody benefits from that. So it's just having that conversation, you know, that you have to do, and you have to keep on doing, and you have to keep on doing over a long period of time. But to try to get people to understand that self-interest properly understood, as even Adam Smith, you know, so that's his phrase, self-interest properly understood actually means something very different from what you think your narrow self-interest is.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Well, good luck with the conversation, because I know you're taking it around the country. And, yeah, really fascinating. Thank you.
Cool.
So you've been listening to Max Rashbrook talking about his book, Inequality, A New Zealand Crisis, and I guess we'll be putting that up on the website as well. Lovely. Thank you.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke People, Events and Issues, brought to you by Island, Art, Craft, Giftware, Clothing and Bric-a-Brac, Ocean View Road, Onirua.
At the moment, we've got Wiramu, who's come in to talk about White Ribbon Day and living without violence. And I have to say, I forgot to mention beforehand that Colin Bearden's coming in after that to talk about the Playwrights Festival and the way it's running this year. It's the third year it's running, but it's going to have a slightly different focus, and it's emphasising on developing directors, and he's coming in a bit later to talk about that. Great, but here I am with Wiramu. Hi, Wiramu.
Kia ora, Shuan.
Kia ora. Tell us, White Ribbon Day, what's it all about?
Okay, well, White Ribbon Day, basically how it started was that on the 6th of December 1989, a man walked into the Ecole Polytechnique, I think that's how you say the name, Ecole Polytechnique and University in Montreal, and he massacred 14 of his female classmates, and his action traumatized a nation, and this brought the issue of violence against women to the forefront. 2 years later, a handful of men in Toronto got together to work on men stopping violence against women, and as a result of that, the White Ribbon Campaign in Canada became an annual awareness raising event. Held between the 25th of November and the 6th of December. In 1999, the United Nations General Assembly declared that the 25th of December as the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, with a white ribbon as its iconic symbol. And so, you know, when we consider that, when we consider the beginnings of that, what's happening in New Zealand is that violence is an epidemic. The statistics tell us that 1 in 3 women are experiencing violence by a partner in their lifetime, while on average, 14 women are killed each year by a member of their own family.
Is that where's that?
In New Zealand.
In New Zealand. There's 14 people are killed by someone in their own family.
That's right. And, you know, men want to be proud fathers, proud uncles, grandfathers, great husband partners, and we want our partners and kids to live in safe homes without violence. And so what White Ribbon is all about this year, it's about taking the pledge. And the pledge is this: I promise never to commit, condone, or remain silent about violence towards women. And, you know, when we consider people like Judge Peter Boshier, who's a chair of the White Ribbon campaign and one of the White Ribbon ambassadors, he says this: while most men are not violent, most violence against women is perpetrated by men.
Mm.
And so this is why the pledge is an important. And so what we're doing on Waiheke in November, on the 24th of November, we are having a bike rally campaign. And it's starting on Sunday the 24th at 10 o'clock. The bikes are gathering out in at Charlie Farley out in Onitangi. And it's headed by Sergeant Peter Knight. And the bike rally will come through Onitangi, through Surf Dow, through Oniroa. And it'll come out to Alistair Park over here by Mora Hall. And we will have a flag-raising ceremony. And we'll have some speeches. We'll be opening it up with Karakia from the chairperson of the Piritahi Marae, a couple of speakers with the ceremony. And then from there, the bike rally will go down through Blackpool, around the Esplanade, and we'll finish off at the Surfdale Hall, where the Rockers, the Waiheke Youth Centre. And we'll have a sausage sizzle and some refreshments for all the people who are involved in it.
Oh, lovely. So is it just guys on the bikes, or is it anyone on motorbikes?
It's open to anybody on motorbikes.
Okay.
And that's us standing up and saying, listen, we say no to violence against women. But if anyone who's got a motorbike want to do a run on November the 24th for this particular cause, you know, the taking the pledge, then it's open.
Mm. And if you haven't got a motorbike but you want to take part, turn up for the sausage sizzle,
absolutely.
Or turn up at Onitangi and you might be able to hitch a ride with someone else, that probably isn't going to work, is it?
Yeah, well, I think we have the flag raising event over at Alistair Park.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yes, and then we also have the refreshments and that down at the Waiheke Youth Centre at the Rock there in Surfdale.
Mm. So,
a great opportunity.
So maybe if you haven't got a bike, you could join it from there.
Absolutely.
And walk down to Surfdale, yeah. or ride your bicycle or, you know, drive or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay, look, that sounds tremendous. So we're focusing here on violence by men towards women. I mean, some people say, well, you know, a lot of women are violent as well.
Uh-huh.
Why is that less of an issue, or... how does that fit into things? Is it relevant, or there's not enough?
Okay. Well, I think, I mean, personally, I think everything is relevant, whether it be men or women. But in particular, this particular campaign is looking at men's issues. It's looking at men taking a stand and being a voice. And, you know, there is a lot of violence in the home. There's a lot of violence in our community. And when we talk about violence, it's not necessarily physical violence. There's emotional abuse. There's all sorts of abuses that's going on. I mean, we just got to look at the roastbusters that have been in the news lately to see that type of abuse towards young girls that are going on in parts of our communities.
And that was quite worrying, wasn't it? What I thought was worrying was, I think I was watching Campbell Live a few days later, and what I thought was really worrying there was that the girls who were defending the boys... didn't seem to think it was strange that the boys were behaving so badly.
Okay.
I don't know if you'd been following that.
I've been following a little bit of it, but it's disturbing, to say the least.
Mm.
And so there's all types of violence that is happening in our communities, and a lot of stuff is happening behind closed doors, sort of thing.
Mm.
And so it's about us being able to stand up and saying, hey, listen, if we know something's going on, if we suspect that there is something happening, we need to intervene. We need to say, hey, listen, from one brother to another, come on, what's going on here? We need to be a voice for that person who's hurting.
Mm. Isn't that very difficult?
It's extremely difficult. And part of it is developing relationships in our community so that we can get that message out there. And I guess this is something that Living Without Violence on Waiheke Island works to achieve, is to develop that relationship with our community so that we can reach into those sensitive areas and be able to work with families, men, women and children, be able to offer support. We've got a fantastic agency manager who's just come on board recently. Her name is Meryn, and she's got some fantastic skills that she's putting in place with Living Without Violence. And all of that is all about networking in our community, getting the message out there, and reaching out to families who are hurting.
What can one do if one thinks that you know people are having a bad time in a family? Like, well, two things. What are the indicators that maybe things aren't very happy in that family? I mean, of course, if it's physical violence, you might see something that shows that. But there's other kinds of things that you think things are not right.
Well, I think that people just know, you know, a person is not being themselves, sort of thing. If you're not seeing the physical scars, then there are emotional scars that are coming through, and there are all sorts of type of indicators that are out there. And it's about just being aware, you know, depression. There's all sorts of stuff that's going on, and just being able to be to read some signs and say, hey, listen, are you okay? Just to ask the question, are you okay? Is there something you want to share, sort of thing?
And so it's being a friend to the person that
absolutely.
You think might be a victim.
Sure.
Yeah. And then aside from, I mean, sometimes when you think of people who, you know, might be violent or emotionally abusive or whatever, they can be quite scary people.
Yeah.
Generally.
Absolutely.
So, okay, one option is to talk to them, but often they're quite intimidating people. Are there other things that one can do? Because that can take quite a lot of courage to stand up to someone.
Yeah. And I think often a number of different abusive behavior patterns, there's other factors such as alcohol or substance abuse sort of stuff that's going on at the same time. But I guess it's just being able to reach out, because for some men, they do want to change, but they don't know how to change, and so it's being able to share with them to say, hey, listen, it's okay. It's okay. Here's a contact number. Here's an agency that works in this particular area. It doesn't cost you anything. There are counselors there that are trained in these areas. There are groups that we run for men. There are groups that we run for children. There are groups that we run for women.
Mm.
And at the end of the day, it's about wellness for the whole family. And it's about letting men know in particular that there is an opportunity there for them to reach out and get help. Because the truth of the matter, a lot of men don't want to appear that there's a problem going on at home.
Mm.
And they're quite shy of that, or quite embarrassed of what is actually really going on. But when they do be able to reach out, when they do get to the stage where they can talk about it and they can start unpacking some of the stuff that's going on, we're finding that there's a lot of healing going on there.
Mm.
And yeah,
great. So basically, if you feel that you might be a victim of someone else's abusive behavior,
yep.
or subject to someone else's abusive behavior, or if you think that you yourself might be a bit abusive, and it can be either men or women, then and also the victims can be either men or women, then you can go in confidence to Living Without Violence and get some advice as to how to move forward.
That's correct.
Is that right?
Yep. Mm.
Great. Okay, good. Well, it sounds like a really interesting event and a great way to draw attention to, to, you know, real issues that we've got in the society. Mm. Well, and one of the things I was quite interested in is so you counsel some of the men and the women?
Yeah, there's counselling sessions. Live and Found Violence Waiheke has runs a men's group. So once a week we have a men's group where men come together and go through with some counsellors some issues relating to power and control and equality. We also run women's groups, South Cairn Boundaries and Exploring Anger programs. And there's also a Kids Standing Strong program that we run, also reaching out to our children.
Oh, great.
And so all those services are available for Living Through Our Violence, as well as one-to-one counselling and as well as couples counselling. Yeah.
Mm, very interesting. Thank you very much.
Kia ora. Thank you.
So we've got the... you can get online and take the pledge by going on to the Living Without Violence website. Would that be right?
White Ribbon
New Zealand. You can take the pledge to be against violence. And you can also join. What time is it starting next week?
It's at 11 o'clock.
Right. So 11 o'clock, you can join the bikers at Onitangi.
10 o'clock at Onitangi.
10 o'clock. Join the bikers at Onitangi for a bike ride led by Sergeant Peter Knight to Allison Park, where they've got the flagpole, they've put up the flag,
speeches,
and then down to Surfdale Hall, where there's going to be a sausage sizzle. So there's stuff for all the family, and what I'm really excited about is finally it's on a Sunday, because the last few years it's been on a Wednesday, or I can't remember the last one when it was, but it's always on a weekday and I can never go, so I'm going to really try and go down there. Lovely. You guys have a lovely day.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, a weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.